This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 32, for Saturday, August 23rd, 2008, Software Factories. In this week's episode, Dave and Larry sit down and talk with Ku-Wei Chung of We Are Mammoth about software factories. Hi, this is Larry Clarkin, and I'm here with Ku-Wei and Dave. We're in downtown Chicago. We're at a little coffee shop in the what used to be the meatpacking district. You're from We Are Mammoth. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what your company does?
That's correct. So, yeah, my name is Ku-Wei Chung. I'm a partner at a company called We Are Mammoth. We are a small organization. We've got seven people right now, and our focus is on building database-driven Flex applications. And all of our databases and our server-side stuff is in C# and .NET and SQL Server. So,
yeah, and your company name is kind of a real contradiction, right? Because I think it actually says that on your website.
It is.
We are Mammoth. No, we're not really.
And you know, that's kind of the idea we're trying to portray. I think especially in today's sort of the way things work in technology today, you don't have to be that, you know, 20,000 person company, I think, to do really large scale things with large scale apps. I mean, a lot of our clients actually are Fortune 500 companies. We work with big interactive agencies, but you know, we can still stay sort of lean and mean and get our work done.
Yeah, and I encourage people to go check out your website because it's the spookiest thing I've ever seen.
yeah, those tusks are real. We had them surgically removed.
So, Dave, I don't think you've been onto their website, you know, but they've actually it's got the three founders or the partners of the company, and you've photoshopped in woolly mammoth tusks.
Those aren't photoshopped; those are real.
Those are real. Yeah. Okay.
I'll clarify that.
When the moon's out, you guys get those or whatever.
Right around, it's like Teen Wolf. Like right around 5 p.m. to start.
So we met you a couple months ago at the Riapalooza event that we had in Chicago, where we got people from both sides of the fence, you know, from the Microsoft side and the Adobe side together, and to talk about Ria technologies. And you were, I think it was either the last presentation of the day or the second to last. So a lot of people were like, you know, tired and worn out.
Yeah, especially me.
Yeah. I was absolutely inspired by your presentation that you did one on software factories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you guys are in a unique position to talk about Ria as a platform because you guys both do, .NET stuff, and you also do, you know, Flex as your primary interface.
Right.
And I think there's a real sweet spot there with Flex as the front end and .NET as the back end.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, so basically kind of where I come in, I think, is I've always been, I think, the advocate for both sort of the Microsoft server-side technologies as well as Flex front-end. I've been building a tool called X2O that I presented at that talk, which basically is a code generator. It is a software factory that allows you to essentially prescribe a data model. So you go to X2O. It's a web-based application. You build the data model out. So in the presentation I gave, we built out a really simple blog. So you have posts, and you've got comments, and you've got authors, and you've got relationships between all those entities.
But by the way, let's build a blog is the new hello world.
It is, exactly. Yeah. Did I mention that at the... I think I mentioned, or I was supposed to say that at my talk, but I think it is totally true.
Yeah. Used to do the hello world, and that's like lame and mundane now.
Exactly.
Now it's like, let's build a blog. Live on stage, we're going to build an entire blog.
Exactly. So that's what we did. And so the idea for X2O and for software factories in general is, you can get so much done, sort of all the underlying plumbing that you typically would have to do by hand. So if you're building a blog, you're going to need to find a way to get all the posts from your database up through C#, in our case, through the server, all the way up to web services, all the way up to the Flex end of things. And our software basically can generate all that infrastructure for us, inserts, updates, the basic CRUD operations, as well as some more complex things. I just saw a couple people from our company walk by, and they go.
Yeah. So, you actually introduced, and we'll talk a little bit more about your actual technology itself in a minute, but you actually introduced it, which is it was a very inspiring conversation. I think a lot of people, when they hear code gen, their knee-jerk reaction is to throw up.
Right. Like, oh, I hate generated code.
Right.
And in my case, you know, being as how old I am, we've been through this before.
Yes.
We tried this in the 90s with, you know, modeling tools at the time.
Right.
You know, we were going to draw pictures, and then code was going to generate out the back end. And if you ever saw the code that was generated back then, it was pretty god-awful.
Yes. That almost got me out of the business back then. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, the approach I took, I think, in the presentation was just sort of differentiating between people and code and kind of, you know, what are the things that people are good at and people aren't good at versus the things that code is good at versus what they're not good at. And, you know, you find that I think the great benefit of code generation is if you think of the qualities of code, code isn't lazy, right? It doesn't ask for more money.
The one that struck me was on your PowerPoint presentation. You actually said code doesn't get tired.
Code doesn't get tired. It doesn't get lazy, and it does things the exact same way. So if you instruct it one way, it's never going to, you know, a month from now, behave differently.
It's never going to read a book about a hot new technique and start all of a sudden changing.
Yeah, it's
how
like, what are all these design patterns doing here? You know, I didn't. You know, so I think the idea is, I've always taken the approach of, you know, we people should be the ones sort of figuring out what the processes are, but code should be the ones that are actually implementing the process. You know, for us, when we need to add a new field in a database, we add it in X2O, and then everything gets generated for us all the way up to the flex layer because we've figured out what that typical process is. And, you know, I think why code generators have gotten a bad rap, I think, also has to do with, I think people perceive it as inflexible. Like, there's only, well, code generators are only going to do things one way, but when you can sort of abstract out the things that you should be doing the same way, sort of those processes, I think that's where the combination of code generation and kind of where people then come in to do more of the custom functionality, that's where the marriage should be, I think.
Yeah. As the architect on the project, what I've always wanted to do is say, all right, now this is the exact way we want X done.
Yeah.
And then get all 12 developers or 20 developers working on the project to do exactly like that. Take your best developer on his best day. And because that's the other thing is that code generation doesn't have a bad day.
Exactly.
Well, I guess it can if it starts throwing errors on you. But
then it's your fault, really.
Yeah, you told it to do the wrong
exactly.
thing. Take your best programmer on his best day, instruct him exactly how you want it to done, work out all the kinks, and then have him go do that 1,000 times.
Right.
And that's the strength of code generation. But we've kind of danced around code generation versus software factories. And really, software factories is what we're talking about. It's not the old school, old days of generating bad code. And it was bad generated code calling bad generated code that was completely unmaintainable.
Yep.
What you're talking about in a software factory is to do specific things, right?
Exactly. You know, in our case, I mean, I think especially as web development has progressed over the last decade or so, we've figured out, you know, you look at agile development and like MVC and all these sort of frameworks that are sort of commonplace now because over time we figured out the best way to distribute data through the correct layers, how they interact with the interface, where logic should be placed. And I think once we got those processes nailed, that's where you can start now saying, let's implement those processes through software factories.
And there are a couple of different examples of software factories that you see today. Hmm. I mean, it's interesting that you know, Ruby on Rails gets a lot of press right now. Ruby as a language gets a lot of press because of, you know, the characteristics of it being a dynamic language. Rails has really, you know, brought, you know, Ruby to the forefront. Mm-hmm. And Ruby itself does a lot of this code generation. It just does it in a specific, you know, framework fashion.
Right.
And that's really one of its strengths, right, is that if you define a class in Ruby and say, all right, generate my Rails app off of that, you're going to get this nice, consistent, you know, nice, consistent feel to the application. It's going to do 90% of what you need it to do.
Right.
And it's going to take into account a lot of the things that you'd want from a web application.
Absolutely.
Like validation. You know?
Right, validation. Again, like, you know, CRUD. So, you know, every object you create in a database, you're going to want to be able to insert into that table, read from it, update it, delete it. So those basic core operations are always going to be in place. So I agree. You know, I think at this point, in code generation and software factories is really about not so. You know, we're so high level at this point, so you can really do so much with just generating all those things instead of having to write them by hand.
I guess my question, just sitting here listening, is you know, just kind of trying to think of, you know, as people are listening to this, you know, our audience and everything, is I don't think we really defined what a software factory is. So what is the difference between sort of a software factory and this code generation?
What I would say is, at least from my perspective, I think software factories goes that extra step where you're actually building tools that can be used by the user. You know, you're going farther than just building sort of the core infrastructure. You know, I know we're going to get into X2O a little bit, but one thing we do is we automatically generate a CMS tool that just from a database. You know, so if you've got a database of for a blog, you've got products or posts and comments and authors, it'll generate a CMS tool you can use to insert all that stuff to manage relationships, that type of thing. So I think software factories, at least for me, gets you past that initial level of code. It gets you really at a high level. So you're actually manufacturing a lot of the tools you're going to need to actually finish building.
Right. So can it be analogous in sort of this sense of the story where, you know, both my parents worked for John Deere. My mom, she worked in the engineering side. My dad, he worked in the foundry where they built combines. And so they had, you know, machines. They built machines to stamp out parts to build a bigger combine.
Right.
So there's essentially an assembly line of all these different machines doing their sort of their specific job to put this one big thing together at the end of the assembly line. Is sort of analogous to that, would you say?
I'd say so, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, any agile framework I've seen, which what I believe is, you know, underneath any agile framework, Rails or Django or CakePHP, those are all code generators or software factories underneath all the sort of marketing fluff that goes on. But, you know, yeah, it's all about sort of building all those tiers and then having them all strung together. So you're really only concentrating on the beginning where you're giving it input and the output, you're already sort of at a very high level. I think the other thing that gets into is one thing we kind of wrap at Weir Mammoth is this concept of a ubiquitous language in software development. You know, the fact that we run SQL Server and .NET code and we use Flex, I think is arbitrary. You know, it could easily be Silverlight, it could easily be Java. You know, the technicalities of those languages and those platforms, I think, is at this point arbitrary. It's really the concept that you can get from one layer to another in sort of the same way.
And I think that's one of the key differentiators between, you know, just, you know, raw code generation and software factory is for you to rework everything to change the output to a different language, you know, should be a trivial task compared with actually your initial construction of the factory.
Right. Absolutely.
And the other thing is, I think, is that a software factory does more than just the actual code generation, because there are lots of things that generate, you know, good quality code. CodeSmith's a good, you know, example of a tool that'll do code generation for you. If you have a structure of a class and you say, this is how I like my class structured, and, you know, I'm going to do 100 of those so I can rip those off one at a time.
Right.
You know, I click CodeSmith and I say, give me one of these. You give it the specific name and it'll fill in all the details. A software factory is going to give you the end-to-end solution and give you a lot of fit and finish things like documentation.
Absolutely.
If you're doing, you know, in-doc type stuff, it's going to, you know, spit those things out.
Right. Documentation, you know, converting, for instance, your tables into RSS feeds or any sort of those end products you can pretty much get from the beginning to the end, usually.
And generally, there's also a specific tool that I don't want to call it an end-user tool, because it's not something that your customer is going to go up and go, you know, let me rip off a new application today, right? It's going to be a developer involved in it.
Right.
But there's a real fit and finish to, you know, how I'm saying this is what I want my database constructed.
Right.
And it doesn't, a lot of people think that code generation takes a lot of creativity out of them. The creativity is in the data model and in the example that you were giving.
Exactly. Yeah. We I think code generation takes the, you know, I agree. I think it's actually the opposite. It lets you focus on those things that are sort of custom to an application that you can't generate. You know, we would never, and I don't think anybody in the Rails camp would ever try to enforce rules that would impede upon, you know, your ability to do something that's a little bit more creative, or, you know, that's not just bare bones application. So,
yeah, and it really is what it's trying to defeat is what I like to call deja vu coding.
Yeah,
like, you know, when you're on your third class and it's like, well, I pretty much have done this one.
Right.
The only difference is the name of the database table that I'm going after.
Right.
And people, you know, first try to use, you know, tools like CodeSmith to get over that. But ultimately, what you need is to look at like a software factory to do all of that CRUD work for you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's still, you know, in every, you know, application, there are things you're not going to be able to code gen. you know, the it's kind of like the secret sauce. That,
exactly.
That last 10% of the application
exactly.
that makes it unique.
Right.
So tell us how you guys handle that.
Well, you know, from our end, so again, going back to our tool, X2O generates all the value objects on the Flex side. So again, going back to this blog concept, you're going to get a collection of posts as an object, a single post as an item, your author collection, your author object, and relationships. You know, a post is going to have a related author. Post is going to have many comments. That infrastructure is built for you. Anything you do custom, really, for us, is we do a lot of our custom work in the Flex end. So we don't have to, you know, we rely more on the client side for many of our applications to do sort of more of the custom, whether it's UI or custom business logic.
So the user experience is your differentiation.
Exactly. Yeah. The other thing that we do in X2O currently is we allow you to actually write custom SQL statements. For sort of more advanced users, so let's say give me all posts that are between these two dates written by this author. If we just did CRUD, it doesn't get you very far. You'd have to kind of, you know, load all of your posts and do all that filtering sort of client side, and that's probably not very efficient. But what we allow you to do is write those very custom SQL statements, and it'll actually generate, you know, the web services and the Flex objects for you. So we kind of have what I like to call sort of like, you've got your basic set of objects, then you have this safety net that lets you do more custom business logic things. And that combination, I think, gets you pretty far to not having to do a lot of that infrastructure work. So we are spending most of our time doing that, the custom UI, the custom logic, and making those applications unique.
So when you guys, and by the way, we should mention that your tool's not released yet.
Yeah, that's correct.
I had to twist your arm to get you to do a podcast before your tool was released, and we might come back down after it's released. But you know, it's just not there yet. But again, we're using your tool, I think, as the example of software factories.
Right, exactly.
But we're really talking about software factories. You know, one of the things is you guys generate all this C# code on the server side,
right?
You know, to wire up your services to do all the database stuff. How much of that generated code is ever touched?
None of it. Okay. And I think that's, you know, for us, that's a huge principle. You know, when we want to be able to sort of at any point be able to regenerate and not have to recall, well, I tweaked this. Now,
you're jumping to my next question, which is, you know, I mean, and I wanted to get to the philosophy is anything that's generated at that layer, we shouldn't mess with.
Right.
Because that, you know, anytime that you touch generated code, unless it's been, you know, carefully thought out from an architectural standpoint
right.
of how you would insert stuff in there,
right.
You're going to break any regeneration. And
right.
regeneration's a fact.
Yes. I think there's sort of two, I guess, rebuttals of that. One way you can get around it in C# is use partial classes. So
I was going to bring up partial classes later.
There you go. So, you know, that's an option where you can... So a partial class basically allows you to distribute a class amongst different files. So you can just sort of silo your generated code as partial classes, and then if you need to sort of extend them in any way, you know, you can just write another file that has whatever your extensions are. Alternatively, you know, if there is a compelling reason, like if you're actually going in your generated code to do something custom, that must be compelling enough to actually consider having that be part of the generated code. You know what I mean? So I think that's sort of our litmus test for when we want to add new features to a software factory is, well, this has come up 3 or 4 times where we wanted to, you know, hack our code. Let's do it right. Let's actually insert it. Make it. You can even make it an option in your software factory.
It's at least something you should think about.
Exactly.
At that point. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's why I think that you know, software factories gives you, especially with partial classes and with the tools we have today, there's very little drawbacks to it. You know. Fact that you can't touch that code, I think, is a good principle, just in development.
And that's more the philosophy, right? I don't like touching that code because it, you know, it challenges the regeneration,
yep.
and not necessarily breaks it, but
yes.
you know, there are ways around it. And fundamentally, you know, if you think that you've got the perfect data model, you're lying to yourself because
right.
there's this thing called customers or end users or whatever
right.
you want to call it. They're going to change their mind. They're going to ask for new features.
Yep.
And you want to be able to regenerate those.
Right, and that's the sheer power of it. You know, think about the struggle you'd have to go through to retweak a database and have to, change your stored procedures and change your server side code and your web services, with a properly built software factory. That's just a matter of changing those inputs and then having it trickle throughout the system.
Well, we've created a whole industry of developer tools for refactoring.
Yeah,
specifically to deal with this issue, right? You know, and that's kind of the converse of the software factory, right?
Yeah,
I don't have generated code, or I can't regenerate my code. Now let me have tools to make it easier to change those
kind
of things.
And I've personally never used them. I've never. I don't have enough trust in them yet. But
they're good tools.
Are they?
But it's like it's like having the two erasers on your pencil. You know. I mean, it's there because, you know, refactoring is hard.
Right.
And you want tools. And ReSharper is a great tool, and there's refactoring tools in the base, you know, Visual Studio tool.
Yeah.
But none of them are going to be perfect, and none of them are going to handle really complex scenarios.
Exactly. Yeah. I agree. I mean, I've got another sort of thought that, back to this whole ubiquitous language concept, being able to generate kind of from one tier to the next. I think we're also seeing that a lot just in, not even in development, but just in, you know, the social networking sites we have. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Posterous.com, but they're actually a blogging tool where you just have to email your posts to an email.
Yeah.
And based on, you know, your content of your email is going to be your posts, and you can attach a series of images. It'll turn it into an image gallery. It'll turn an audio file into an audio player on your blog. So I think we're seeing that concept of, you know, you don't need to do all that infrastructure, even in real-world applications, you know, that end users are using. So, I mean, end users, I think, are also getting that a taste of what sort of these factories are all about, maybe in an indirect way.
So where do you think factories are headed? I mean, because I personally think that we're in the phase now where we're getting some trust with them.
Yeah.
Because we've been burned by code generation in the past.
True.
And now we're starting to get some trust in them.
Yeah, I've been really impressed just with how far we've gotten, strictly from the technical point of view, how far we've gotten with how much we can do with just a database. I think what we're going to see in the future is a little bit, you know, like what we're seeing with cloud computing and with web services, sort of remote web services, being able to generate your code online and not have to sort of work on your desktop. For instance, being able to have web services built for you so that you can just work locally but plug into those web services without having to download and install, you know, I mean, even with Rails, you have to install the framework, you have to install Ruby. And so I think maybe that's the next step where it's just one level removed from...
Well, I guess that would be the ultimate, right?
You
use an online tool to generate this stuff, and you deploy the services in the cloud to cloud databases, you know.
Exactly.
And then the only thing that's really running locally ever is, you know,
is your client app, yeah. if you want. Yeah, exactly. So that to me is the next natural step. But as far as, you know, what will change with the actual generated stuff, I think we've gotten pretty far now. I wouldn't even know the answer to that at this point.
So Dave, as the developer, you know, developer evangelist, you know, so how do you feel about, you know, code generation software factories?
Well, it's, you know, I was sitting here thinking that, you know, if they build up too many software factories, are developers going to have a job?
That's true.
So, I mean,
that's our ultimate goal, though, right?
Yeah, there you go. So
we all want to live on a farm.
Well, Dave, I think that, you know, that they say that the average company has 100 years worth of backlogs, worth of projects they can tackle. So let's say we make developers, like, you know, 400% more efficient, then it's down to 25 years, right? I don't think developers are going anywhere anytime soon.
No, because somebody still has to create these things too, you know. I was listening to, you know, some other podcasts, and then people were talking about they're waiting for the day where, you know, developers or whoever, it doesn't even have to be developers, it could be anybody, you know, one day when we can just think of what we want and boom, poof, there it is. You know, it's like, you know, the computer is able to interpret your thoughts and to generate whatever it is that you're thinking versus, yeah, you know, type in some sort of, you know, arbitrary, you know, sequence of characters into some sort of, you know, application that then gets compiled into an executable, you know. So it's going to, you know, things are changing, obviously. I mean, this industry as a whole is in its infancy, right? And yeah. Larry's going nuts over here, and I think he wants the microphone.
So what I've been working on, and maybe you guys could take this, you know, the next step with your software factory, yeah, is for years, about like 15 years, I've been working on a PowerPoint compiler.
Okay.
Because your business users give you, like, you know, hey, here's what we want to do in the form of a PowerPoint. And it'd be great if you could just, you know, put that as a command line into your software factory and spit out whatever they want.
Right. 15 years working on the PowerPoint compiler. Now that's efficiency for you.
We'll have that done next week.
It's the natural language part of it, you know. That
I mean, I think the key is that we don't tell anybody that Software Factories exists. So that's been my dream. I just want to push a button and leave for 4 weeks, come back and tell everybody it's done, and then. But maybe that won't happen.
Yeah. Well, and what you want to do is you want to go for 4 weeks and then come back and push the button.
Yeah,
that's
true.
You don't want them to find that it's already done, you know.
Or we can just have it, you know, generate a quarter of the project every week, so it has more of a human-like quality to it, maybe.
It actually leads me to a companion question, and that is, you know, where does test-driven development intersect software factories? Because this has always been a question of mine, because, you know, test-driven development, unit testing is very important. We realize that as an industry now.
Right.
Certainly has been proven that it increases code quality. Any tests that are generated as part of a software factory are automatically
going to
test and
going to
fail as appropriate.
Right, exactly.
So, I don't think you could generate a software factory with unit test that the unit test would fail unless it was a test case specifically looking for an exception.
Exactly. I agree. So I think you're right. I've battled that question too. You know, where does that intersect? I'm not sure, you know, to be honest. I think we'll have to wait and see.
I mean, is that something that the factory could also generate in a sense, or have output, the ability to self-test itself, whatever generates?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, for me, that's, I kind of agree with Larry in the sense that, you know, I think test-driven development, as far as software factories goes, has to be at a higher level where it is testing sort of, you know, those exceptional cases as opposed to...
I mean, certainly it could test the environment, right?
Right.
So you're expecting... So what you could do is you could load data into a database. At that point, you're testing the specific data, you know, in that case. But how much environmental testing should we do? I mean, fundamentally, we're working with runtimes. In the case of your client, you guys do Flex, so it's running on the Flash runtime.
Right.
In the case of your server-side stuff, it's C#, so it's running on the .NET framework. How much testing of that environment you do need to do, because it's already in a sandbox?
Exactly. I mean, for us, you know, we've with our software, we've had zero problems. And I think the great thing about software factories is once you find that problem, it replicates itself everywhere, you know. So
yeah.
I think that when you actually build a software factory correctly and you're able to test it a few times on a few different clients and it's worked properly, you can, at least for me, I feel pretty secure that that's never going to break, you know. So
yeah, it's like testing a regular expression with the regular expression, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm just sitting here thinking about software factories and just think about the work I did in the past, you know, my consulting days. And it's like, you know, you go into these, you know, Fortune 100, Fortune 500 companies, you know, typically your applications you're building are, you know, just data entry forms, you know, your customer profile screens, your, you know, your user administration screens, your master detail relationship screens, you know, orders and order details and stuff. So, I mean, there's definitely, you know, a place obviously for software factories, because, you know, from looking at my consulting days, like Larry said, you know, it's like push the button, come back 4 weeks, and, you know, say, maybe check it off and say, you know, click the done button, say, okay,
right.
It took me 4 weeks to get the work done, I'm done. But essentially you're generating the same things. Maybe it has a different skin to it, maybe it has different data elements to it, but in the end a lot of these applications are the same kind of applications.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Right.
And that's again, I think that's why it comes back to, I think software factories are sort of here to stay. There's a real viable business behind that, and you're not losing any of that to the customizations you might need to
right.
to do.
I think the hard part, just thinking about from a developer standpoint and building these things or putting, you know, creating these software factories, is where does the integration points come into play? How do you wire these things up together?
Yeah, you know, for us, we've been able to wire up everything from the database side, and we build our own services, and we actually build the value objects that actually point to those services.
And value object, because we've got a .NET slanted audience.
Exactly.
You mentioned it earlier, and I, you know.
I only say value object for the Adobe crowd, so.
All right, can you translate for the .NET crowd?
Basically, your data access layer in ActionScript, so your model.
Yeah, it's like your local type class, right?
Right, exactly. Your strongly typed objects. So, you know, that for us...
And those get mapped from your web service call, right?
Exactly. So,
yeah.
So in fact, when you're using our tool, you don't need to know that there are web services available. That all kind of gets infiltrated through those value objects, through
cool.
the modeling layer. So, yeah, I mean, you can go very far with it. You know, I think that's what's nice about software factories, too, is that it sort of dissolves a lot of the things that you just don't need to know about. You know, like if you look at architecture, I mean, there's in this cafe, for instance, there's plumbing everywhere behind these walls and how those electrical sockets work. I mean, we're at the point now where we don't know or and don't care, but we just know reliably that those we can plug in our laptop. You know, we've got running water, and that's kind of, I think, the metaphor you can use for factories, too.
Except to, like, know where the air conditioning went.
Yeah, exactly. That's the custom part that you can't ever generate, I think.
Yeah. You know, so for instance, like, you know, we used to, like, really be, you know, I mean, 5 years ago, I was really bunched up about serialization, thinking a lot about serialization. You know, now I don't think about it anymore because when I reference a WCF or an Asimex web service, there's a proxy class generator
exactly.
that's taken
and
care
it's
of
just
for
all
me.
Underneath. You know, the same thing for XML. I don't ever think about, you know, XML or sort of like the structure of those markup languages anymore.
And now we're taking it to, you know, a higher level that not only do I not have to worry about serialization anymore, I don't have to worry about that there's a web service that's doing validation and going back all the database and coming back.
Exactly.
Well, I think it also has to do with trust, too, right? So you say you don't have to worry about that proxy class being generated. Well, you might, because if whatever tool is generating that proxy class, what if it did it wrong? You're just kind of assuming that it did it right? So there's going to be a lot of trust involved with these that as you use these different factories, as you use these different tools, about what the output is. It's going to, you know, either it's going to be an industry standard that gets sort of, you know, this is the tool that everybody uses,
right?
Or it's just sort of that trust level that has to build up over time. Because once again, you're assuming a lot of things. If you're betting your business on that, well, then, you know, you better know what's going on.
Yeah, but, you know, likewise, I would bet on that, you know, if that trust is broken, if there are flaws to the system, you know, to correct that problem in a software factory, I think is exponentially easier than to find it in sort of a completely custom built app where you've got to find who's that developer that did that. And, you know, like we mentioned before, having a developer team of 20 where you've got to have your best developer on your best day kind of lead that team. I mean, you're not going to be able to enforce 20 guys to do things the exact same way.
Yeah, it certainly cuts down on the code review process.
It does.
You know, where you're bringing all the code into, you know, kind of the team standard, right?
Right, exactly.
Because it's there.
Exactly. And the need to socialize with people.
All right. Well, I think that we're pretty much to the end of our podcast. We want to thank you for your time today. Okay, thanks for being
on. Actually, can I just mention that, so with regards to X2O, we are planning to do a launch at the end of September. And you can go to our website, wearemammoth.com, and sign up for a news email list that we'll hopefully distribute in the next couple of months.
And also, do you have a blog or anything that you like
do.
To plug?
It's at wearemammoth.com/sprout. Our blog is called Sprout. It's from, we had an old company name that it had more sense to the name. It makes no sense now. But you can also get to our blog from our website, too. So, and we actually talk a lot about software factories and just sort of the quirkiness of what we do as developers, and I think it's pretty interesting.
No, it's great. Yeah. Great reading. So we'd like to thank you for being on Thirsty Developer.
All
thanks,
right.
Coy.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com.